got to love my right wing point of view. But right wingers need love too. One more time, here we go. Right wingers need love too. We all need love, indeed we do. Now you don't have to love my right wing point of view. But right wingers need love. Right wingers need love. Right wingers need love too.
Art and Artifice. Bob Dylan, Tom T. Hall, and the Cult of Woody Guthrie. Friends, Romans, Kentuckians, pinko religionists and true connoisseurs of American popular music, and also Arlo and the crew back on the Group W bench. Howdy, neighbors. It's Lonesome Al Barger yakking at you on this cold as heck almost spring day back here in the turnip patch this day of our Lord, March the 5th of 2015. A couple of weeks back, I was reading these rambling remarks from a Bob Dylan speech, and I found myself arguing back again into the computer monitor at the Laurel Public Library. Bull crappy, as my mother would say. Now, they know me at the library, so they're not too alarmed by such displays. But rather than subject Miss Deirdre to me rambling on about it for an hour, I figured it'd be better to break it down and organize it into hopefully at least a halfway coherent statement so that I understand what I'm thinking myself. So, I'm a talk on art versus artifice in popular music, through a critical comparison of the actual music of Woody Guthrie and my hero Tom T. Hall. Dear hearts, this is going to take a while for me to break it down properly. So, smoke 'em if you got 'em and kick back while I show you why and how Tom T. Hall is seriously 100 times greater artist than the cultural fraud that is the Cult of Woody Guthrie. The musician's charity Music Cares named Bob Dylan the 2015 Person of the Year. They got some big names to come out and sing his songs. Then Dylan talked for over 30 minutes, which is pretty unusual for him. Let us consider some critical and really just downright disrespectful remarks he made about Tom T. Hall. Bob Dylan said, quote, "Now some might say Tom's a great songwriter. I'm not going to doubt that. At the time he was doing this interview, I was actually listening to a song of his on the radio. It was called I Love. I was listening to it in a recording studio, and he was talking about all the things he loves. An every man kind of song, trying to connect with people, trying to make you think that he's just like you, and you're just like him. We all love the same things, and we're all in this together. Tom loves little baby ducks, slow-moving trains, and rain. He loves old pickup trucks and little country streams, sleeping without dreams, bourbon in a glass, coffee in a cup, tomatoes on the vine, and onions. Now listen, I'm not ever going to disparage another songwriter. I'm not going to do that. I'm not saying it's a bad song. I'm just saying it might be a little overcooked. But you know, it was in the top 10 anyway. Tom and a few other writers had the whole Nashville scene sewed up in a box. If you wanted to record a song and get it in the top 10, you had to go to them. And Tom was one of the top guys. They were all very comfortable doing their thing." Okay, end of Bob Dylan rant. Resume Lonesome Al rant. Well, let me take a moment to start with a side note of amusement at the Bobster's ridiculous fantasy about Tom T. being a kingpin of some Nashville mafia who ran things because the fix was in. Let the record reflect that, in fact, Tom T. Hall was a preacher's kid from Kentucky who wrote a lot of great songs that tens of millions of people have been happy to spend their money on. If the actual masses of people get any vote as to who is a man of the people, then Tom T. qualifies. My real jumping off point here, though, is Dylan's characterization of Tom T as a corporate fake. Quote, trying to make you think that he's just like you and you're just like him. Really? Robert Zimmerman of the fake name and elaborately fabricated celebrity persona is mocking this country boy for writing like he's from the country? Psychological projection much, Bob? Speaking of a fraudulent fabricated persona, trying to make you think that he's just like you and you're just like him, this brings us to Dylan's all-time hero and role model, Woody Guthrie. The ongoing cult of Woody Guthrie as an American national treasure is one of the biggest ridiculous cultural frauds in American history. Mostly, Guthrie is revered because of his persona and really not so much for any actual art that he created. So let us briefly consider the Guthrie persona and then try to set that aside so we can bring in Tom T and talk about their actual music. I want to try to separate the actual art from the artifice of the cult of personality. By his actual trade, Woody Guthrie was a songwriter and musician. He really wasn't much of a musician, but he marketed himself with a kind of cheesy prefabricated persona as a Dust Bowl refugee, as he put it in the extended talking in his government endorsement in multiple volumes of fawning Library of Congress recordings that officially certify him as a government-approved national treasure. Basically, what he got through was play-acting this simplistic role that he was Tom Joad, walked right out of the grapes of wrath. Of course, this meant being a good progressive liberal, speaking up for the common men against the dirty, jolly bankers and politicians. Whenever there is injustice, Woody will be at the Library of Congress reporting. You really should listen to this Department of the Interior guy from the Library of Congress riffing cheesy Woody mythology over the start of the Lost Train Blues, which is the very first recording of the Library of Congress stuff.
The Lost Train Blues, played on a harmonica and a guitar by Woody Guthrie from Okemo, Oklahoma. Woody knows what that lost train means because he's ridden off the Red Ball Freight from one end of the country to another. In a few minutes, we're going to begin a conversation with Woody Guthrie about life in the Southwest, about where he's from and where he went and what happened. Woody Guthrie is, I guess, about 30 years old from the looks of him, but he's seen more in those 30 years than most men see before they're 70. He hasn't sat in a warm house or a warm office to see what he's been interested in looking at. He's gone out in the world. He's looked at the faces of hungry men and women. He's lived in hobo jungles. He's performed on picket lines. He's sung his way through every bar and saloon between Oklahoma and California. And listen to that Red Ball roll.
He's seen more in his 30 years than most men see in a lifetime, and so on. Oh, please. Listening to three volumes of Guthrie's Library of Congress recordings puts me in mind of Robert Heinlein's quote about how a government-sponsored artist is an incompetent whore. This messianic prophet of the people shtick is just catnip for generations of progressive pussycats for whom their left-wing politics is their religion. He's some kind of revered saint in the church of progressivism. It's precisely curious that Dylan's principal attack on Tom T was that he supposedly has this phony persona as a man of the people. Because exactly that kind of shtick is the whole freaking point of Woody Guthrie. Moreover, the pure artifice of reinventing yourself into a fake make-believe public personality, was the main thing Dylan got from Guthrie. Guthrie's pure fakery was exactly what made him a role model for Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, among others. While I am a proud, certified, bitter, clinging, right-wing nut job, I don't particularly hold Guthrie's politics against him. Let me make a couple of brief points on that count. First of all, I find that what I know of his politics to be just common liberal foolishness, but not particularly wicked. Now, this would be as opposed, for example, to the truly contemptible Pete Seeger, who spent most of a century as an avowed communist and specifically a supporter of Joe Stalin. His robust public and professional support of the worst murderer in history earns him some measure of eternal culpability for the millions of people, women and children, murdered by his hero, no matter how nice old Pete may have been to his own. What I'm saying is that while Guthrie espoused garden variety American liberal foolishness, he was not corroborating, aiding, and abetting mass murdering enemies of America. The other reason I don't hold Guthrie's politics much against him is because he was a musician, and thus I mostly judge him as a musician. It matters little to me that I might disagree with the political sentiments expressed in some of his lyrics from most of a century ago. Hey, The Clash put out London Calling when I was 17, and I loved those communist revolutionaries howling in the moonlight. Even as a teenager, though, I recognized that the lyrical sentiment was nonsense. But the musical emotions were very real, and the guitar player kicked much ass. It's an elementary point that liking a song doesn't mean that you literally endorse the lyrical sentiment in the text. My many hours listening to the Soul Stirrers, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and Elvis Gospel do not necessarily mean that I believe in the resurrection of Christ. Music, politics, and religion are all separate things. Let's pause in for just a minute to clarify these basic distinctions with a very brief introduction to philosophy. You should take notes here. Philosophy is basically the study of the meaning of life. By a framework presented originally by Ayn Rand, philosophy will boil down to five major branches, five main topics that can be summed up with five questions. Number one is metaphysics. How did we get here? Is there a God, and if so, what is his nature? Number two is ethics. By what rules and with what goals should you live your life? Number three is politics. What is the proper goal and legitimate authority of government? Number four is aesthetics. What is beauty? What makes this a good song, movie, or book? Number five is epistemology, the theory of knowledge. How do we know things, and what does it mean when we say that we know something? The point of this philosophy dissertation, as it relates to the current discussion, is that from the get-go, you need to know what thing it is that you are talking about. The question at hand is not Woody or Tomty or Dylan's politics, religion, or ethics, but the aesthetic qualities of their work. How good are their songs? So having cut our way through the extraneous stuff, let us consider Woody Guthrie's songs and records. That's the actual thing on which a musician should be judged. To that end, I am, as I write, listening to all 15 Woody Guthrie albums that I have. That's a total of some 236 tracks, including 3 CDs worth of Library of Congress recordings and 3 children's albums. I mashed that all up in random play with 100-odd Tom T songs. As an actual musician, first of all, Woody Guthrie was just a horrible singer. I found his Library of Congress recording of Jimmy Rogers' California Blues particularly painful to listen to. Now, Bob Dylan, at least in his prime, was actually a particularly good and effective singer. But Guthrie couldn't carry a tune in a bucket without spilling most of it. That's not really even my opinion, but just the plain reality of the recorded evidence. Plus, he hardly ever arranged or recorded his songs with any more arrangement than his simplistic guitar playing. That's okay, though, because his musical bag was songwriting. His main claim as a musician is that he wrote "This Land Is Your Land." Now, that is a pretty good song, though it doesn't especially blow my skirt up. It does have a catchy tune, but Guthrie did not actually write the melody. So saying that Guthrie wrote this song is largely a fraud from jump. Not that it's necessarily a big sin for a folk singer to borrow a tune, but he doesn't get credit for actual composition here.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me.
What he did write was the lyric. As to the aesthetic art of how the words are drawn, he gave a very appealing, patriotic-sounding socialistic anthem. He's giving vivid descriptions of the beautiful American countryside and waving wheat fields and such. The bad thing is that most of the time folks do not sing or record the last verse that he wrote about the private property sign, the other side of which was made for you and me. Woody himself doesn't include the verse on any of the recordings that I have. But that last verse is really the most distinctive part of his lyric, and it's only there that he honestly actually makes his real point in a song that was originally written in some anger as a rejoinder to Irving Berlin's God Bless America. Apparently a sentiment like God Bless America, land that I love, was as offensive to him as it would be to Barack Obama a couple of generations hence. It strikes me as fraudulent, really, to sing "This Land Is Your Land" without that verse. At that point, you're just making a general travelogue and trying to get away with slipping in your polemical point as a presumption rather than being honest about it. I have one recording where the singer actually sings the verse about private property, beyond which it is also perhaps the best recording I've heard of a Guthrie song. So let's stop to listen to this 2004 recording by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Actually, by the time she gets done rephrasing the lyric in this soul arrangement, she's probably come closer to writing an original melody than Guthrie did. Have a listen and dig it. because I want to give Guthrie his best case, and this is the best this song will ever sound.
This land is your land.
Beyond that, Woody Guthrie just wasn't much of a tunesmith. Most of what he's singing sounds just alike, with minor variations of a just absolutely generic blues tune. Calling a recording a talking blues Most of the time means just preemptively declaring that you haven't bothered to actually write a melody. This is why you don't hear very many Guthrie songs being recorded and played on the radio. They're just not very catchy. Generally, you might want to start out writing a song by coming up with a memorable melodic phrase, also known as a hook. Then you extend the original theme or write variations. Maybe change key signatures or work in an unusual and distinctive chord or two. And perhaps another new melodic section for a bridge or climax. This is not arcane advanced placement grad school stuff. It's just basic songwriting 101. Guthrie never in life showed interest in even trying anything like this. He thus largely failed at the most significant aspects of his artistic craft. Carefully reviewing all his stuff, I can only pick out maybe a half dozen halfway memorable actual songs. It strikes me that he wasn't really even intending to try to write good tunes or develop his musical craft. Now that's just about as bad a thing as you could say about a supposed musician. Dylan once said of his own songwriting that he didn't care about melodies much. He claimed he just jotted down bits of lyrics on scraps of paper, and that when he had a shoebox full, then he had a new album. Now, there is no way he wrote something like Tangled Up in Blue that way. But that philosophy is the proper Guthrie-esque line. You don't need song craft or any harmonic sophistication. All you need is three chords and the truth. Let me take a moment to call bull crappy on that. This sentiment reflects people letting their political religion take over their whole consciousness like a cancer, eating up their sensibilities so that they can't even see anything else. If you want to follow this thread a little further, look up my White Stripes Nation manifestos at morethings.com, which were parodies of this kind of thinking. True words or not, good music requires a lot more than saying that bankers are greedy or bleeding, "Bush lied, people died." It takes a lot more than that even to write a good artistically drawn lyric. Going back to our Philosophy 101 primer, that's just a really dumb basic category error. Politics are politics. And musical aesthetics are art. They are totally different things. Now, if you want a song with a socially conscious lyric, why, old Tom T. Hall could show you how to turn it into actual art. He actually wrote a lot of protest and topical political songs with well-drawn lyrics and actual melodies to carry his point. If you want more blunt political points, check out Hang 'em All.
If they hang 'em all, they get the guilty. That's what you say we ought to do. If they hang 'em all, they get the guilty. But remember, they're gonna hang you too. If they hang 'em all, they get the guilty. If they hang 'em all, they cannot miss. If they hang them all, they get guilty. Been a lot of problems solved like this. If they hang them all, they get...
Or I Want to See the Parade. Or 100 Children.
Kill all the flowers. Today this is your world, tomorrow it's ours.
Leave us pure water and forest uncut. Think of tomorrow, leave something for us.
Or America the Ugly.
Then he went to the Medicare centers and he saw all the old people there. It seems that the young generation just didn't want them in their hair. He saw the poor man working it out while the mighty rich lives high. And my friend, that brings a gleam to the enemy's eye. There were some folks had plenty and some had none at all. The enemy knows when a heart gets hard, the country is bound to fall. If we get heads and hearts together, we won't have to hear them say, America, the ugly today. America, the ugly today.
Indeed, he could have been, per the title of his excellent song recorded by Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood, the Greenwich Village Folk Song Salesman. Why, Tom T's got songs about Detroit and Vietnam and the Economic Opportunity Plan. Let's consider now his first big hit song where he made his commercial bones. Recorded by Jeannie C. Riley in 1968. First of all, Harper Valley PTA has a catchy tune even without the words. Da 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 da. If you ever heard the song, you could probably sing a good part of the tune. The tune itself conveys a pretty good amount of the message and mood. It's a saucy female tune.
I want to tell you all a story about a Hopper Valley widowed wife who had a teenage daughter who attended Hopper Valley Junior High. Mama, got a note here from the Hopper Valley PTA. Well, the note said, Mrs. Johnson, you're wearing your dresses way too high. It's reported you've been drinking and running around with men and going wild. And we don't believe you ought to be bringing up your little girl this way. Terry Hopper Valley PTA. Well, it happened that PTA was gonna meet that very afternoon. And they were sure surprised when Mrs. Johnson wore her mini skirt into the room. And as she walked up to the blackboard, I can still recall the words she had to say. To address this meeting of the Hopper Valley PTA. Well, there's Bobby Taylor sitting there, and seven times he's asked me for a date. And Mrs. Taylor sure seems to use a lot of ice whenever he's away. And Mr. Baker, can you tell us why your secretary had to leave this town? Shouldn't Widow Jones be told to keep her when the shades all pull completely down? Well, Mr. Hopper couldn't be here 'cause he stayed too long at Kelly's bar again. And if you smell Shirley Thompson's breath, you'll find she's had a little nip of gin. you have the nerve to tell me you think that as the mother I'm not fit. Well, this is just a little Peyton place, and you're all Harper Valley hypocrites. No, I wouldn't put you on, cause it really did, it happened just this way.
Lyric here is highly socially conscious, a feminist rebuke of a bunch of small-town hypocrites who presume to critique the personal life of a student's mother on official letterhead. It's not merely a dumb polemic, though, but a carefully wrought story about a teenage girl watching her mother rebuke these schmucks. Tom T is often called the storyteller, literary billing the man lived up to 100 times over. There's the narrative perspective of the young daughter character with the song, the mother demonstrating for her how to stand up for herself, and then mom's final confrontation with the tawdry behavior of all those specific people presuming to condemn her. So, besides having a real melody, this song has 100 times more literary skill in the lyric than anything Woody Guthrie ever attempted. They eventually made a movie out of this song. Woody Guthrie doesn't really have any songs she could do that with. Tom T has 100 different songs with stories that you could get a good movie plot out of. You could start with the narrator's awkward alienation from his roots in Homecoming, or Ravishing Ruby waiting tables and obsessing over the lost father. And the Lord knows there could be a beautiful movie made of the hero-worshipping child narrator and the tragic local guitar hero in The Year That Clayton Delaney Died.
I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. They said for the last 2 weeks that he suffered and cried. It made a big impression on me, although I was a barefoot kid. They said he got religion at the end, and I'm glad that he did. Clayton was the best guitar picker in our town. I thought he was a hero, and I used to follow Clayton around. I often wondered why Clayton, who seemed so good to me, never took his guitar and made it down in Tennessee. Well, Daddy said he drank a lot, but I could never understand. I knew he used to pick up in Ohio with a five-piece band. Clayton used to tell me, son, you better put that old guitar away. Ain't no money in it, it'll lead you to an early grave. I guess if I'd admit it, Clayton taught me how to drink booze. I can see him half-stoned to picking out the lovesick blues. When Clayton died, I made him a promise I was gonna carry on somehow. I'd give $100 if he could only see me now. I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. Nobody ever knew it, but I went out in the woods and I cried. While I know there's a lot of big preachers that know a lot more than I do, but it could be that the good Lord lacks a little picking too. Yeah, I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died.
Note from these previews that all these narrations are built into actual memorable melody, rhythm, and harmony. Plus, they're all filled out with appealing and detailed arrangements. Let's drop back now to give some consideration and credit to Woody Guthrie for his best song. Besides This Land, he's got one song that actually gets covered from time to time, Pretty Boy Floyd. This one song has a memorable tune and a little bit of an actual storyline, making a character sketch. The Byrds have probably the most famous Guthrie cover on their widely acclaimed Sweetheart of the Rodeo album, and certainly one of the best. Now, in fairness to Woody, this here is the best any song of his is ever going to sound, which in this case is pretty excellent, even someone like me who doesn't buy Woody. So let's listen to the best case for Woody.
Well, gather around me, children, a story I will tell about Pretty Boy Floyd, the outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee on a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in a wagon as into town he rode.
Now, the day Woody wrote that song was obviously a unique moment of artistic and melodic inspiration. His supporters carry on about how he wrote over 1,000 songs, as if this quantity in itself implied that he was good. But a good percentage of his songs were other people's melodies with stupidly rewritten lyrics. For actually probably one of his better examples of this, let's listen to the 1949 Farmer Labor Train.
From the high Canadian Rockies to the land of Mexico, city and the country, wherever you may go, through the wild and windy weather, the sun and sleet and rain, comes a whistling through the country, this farmer labor train. Listen to the jingle and the rumble and the roar. She's rolling through New England to the West Pacific shore. It's a long time we've been waiting now, she's whistling round the bend. Roll on into Congress on that farmer labor train. Why? lumberjacks and teamsters and sailors from the sea. There's farming boys from Texas and the hills of Tennessee. There's miners from Kentucky, there's fishermen from Maine. Every worker in the country rides that farmer labor train. There's warehouse boys and truckers and guys that skin the cats, men that run the steel mills, the furnace and the blast. Through the smoky factory cities or the hot and dusty plains, and the cushions there crowded on this farmer labor train. Listen to the jingle and the rumble and the roar. She's rolling through New England to the West Pacific shore. It's a long time we've been waiting, now she's whistling round the bend. Ride on into Congress on that farmer labor train. There's folks of every color and they're riding side by side from the swamps of Louisiana and across the Great Divide. From the wheat fields and the orchards and the lowing cattle range, and they're rolling on to victory on this farmer labor train. This train pulled into Washington a bright and happy day. When she steamed into the station, you could hear the people say, there's that farmer labor special, she's full of union men, heading on the White House on the farmer labor train.
Woo, woo. So, he just wrote some new words to the tune of the Wabash Cannonball. And he did a piss poor job of that. For starters, he ruins the melody. This isn't that he was changing it up with new distinctive twists to make it his own, because the tune is much less distinctive after he gets done with it. He just butchered the tune because he didn't have the basic technical skill even to simply write words to fill the pre-existing tune. Besides elementary technical stuff like not being able to get the right number of syllables and such, it's not a very creative or artistically expressive lyric. It's just that the train is full of working men heading to D.C. for some rather unspecified rabble-rousing. There's no imagery of any particular people on the train or their specific beefs. I'm not saying that because of politics. It's just a poorly executed lyric. And executed is just the right word for what he did to one of the all-time classic train songs. For counterexample, let's consider Tom T. and his beloved Miss Dixie writing about a coal mining man.
Hand me that guitar. Give me a pick light. I think I got something to say. I'm a coal mining man and I am who I am, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm a coal mining man, 3 miles underground. I work where the wind don't blow. I got kids and a wife, it's my chosen way of life, and I help make America's economy grow. American flag on the back of my truck means I'm proud of the USA. And I mind to pay my bills digging coal out of these hills while my neighbors raise a batch of corn and hay. I'm a coal mining man, 4 miles underground. I work where the wind don't blow. I got kids and a wife, it's my chosen way of life, and I help make America's economy grow. In my hair, some call it dirt. I got dust where the sun don't shine, or they don't see my soul. They don't understand coal or see it bright as diamonds in the mine. I'm a coal mining man, alive. And I helped make America's economy roll. And I helped make America's economy roll.
Besides having a catchy original melody, you can get some good from parsing out the text of this character expressing his pride in his chosen way of life and his perspective on his place in the local community and the nation. On his best day, Woody Guthrie just flatly did not have the literary skill to do a character sketch like this. On the other hand, let me give some credit to Woody for the Jolly Banker. Now, the wicked mustache-twirling Tom Crinker is in no way a believable or compelling character, but it is a catchy little tune. The literary technique of the text is not on Tom T's level, but over several decades, I pretty many times have found myself randomly singing, "I'm a jolly banker, am I?" I would probably consider this Guthrie's third best song, so let's give the man his due and take a quick listen.
My name is Tom Crinker and I'm a jolly banker. I'm a jolly banker am I. I safeguard the farmers and widows and orphans, singing I'm a jolly banker am I. When dust storms are sailing and crops they are failing, I'm a jolly banker am I. I check up your shortage and bring down your mortgage, singing I'm a jolly banker am I. When money you're needing and mouths you are feeding, I'm jolly banker am I. I'll plaster your home with a furniture loan, singing I'm a jolly banker am I. If you show me you need it, I'll let you have credit. I'm a jolly banker am I. Just bring me back two for the one I lend you, singing I'm a jolly banker.
Song closely for my research here, I do note that this tune is at least a kissing cousin of the classic Irish folk song Molly Malone. Let's look at one more angle of comparison between the art of these two songwriters. It appears to me that Guthrie made some of his most listenable and probably more commercial records as a children's artist. I have three Guthrie children's albums. From my perspective, these records seem to be the ones where Woody was really trying to come up with records that people would want to actually buy and listen to. So here's my pick for Woody's best children's song, Riding in My Car.
Mm-hmm.
Take me riding in the car, car, take me riding in the car, car. Take you riding in my car, car, I'll take you riding in my car. Click, clank, open up a door, girls. Click, clank, open up a door, boys. Front door, back door, click a dick, clack, take you riding in my car. Climb, climb, rattle on the front seat. Spray ice, prattle on the back seat. Turn my key, step on the starter, take you riding in my car. Engine, it goes, engine, it goes. Front seat, back seat, boys and girls, take you riding in my car. Trees in the houses, walk along. Trees in the houses, walk along. Truck in a cart and a garbage can, I'll take you riding in my car. Ships and little boats chug along. Ships and little boats chug along. Take you riding in my car. I'm gonna zoom you home again. I'm gonna zoom you home again. Roll home, take you riding in my car. I'm gonna let you blow the horn. I'm gonna let you blow the horn. Well, I'll take you riding in my car.
To me, this song, among a number of these children's recordings, seemed to have a lot more real heart and feeling and human empathy to them than his political broadsides. Plus, Riding in My Car's got a good beat. On the other hand, Tom T. could represent as a children's artist with Sneaky Snake, or I Love, the specific track Dylan mocked. Those were both major million-selling commercial radio hits. But let's just go to his excellent 1988 album, Country Songs for Kids. Every single song on this album is excellent, and I particularly enjoy his empathy for those struggling with the language in the word song. I, too, struggle with Fortu polyisming predenficole. Hey, I said it! But for the Tom T. Children's exhibit here, let's consider why is it so hard to say no?
Why is it so hard to say no? It's only a two-letter word. It's not like we say something weird. It's nothing that they haven't heard. Why is it so hard to say no? It's just as easy as yes. Some people do things that they shouldn't be doing because they can't say no, I guess. Why is it so hard to say no? Are there some feelings to hurt? What do they expect when someone suggests, let's go outside and eat dirt? Why is it so hard to say no instead of just saying okay? No means I don't and I won't and I can't. In other words, no means no way. Why is it so hard to say no? It's hard to say no to a friend. But sometimes a friend can be wrong about things. You have to say no in the end. Why is it so hard to say no? We don't like to let people down. But we must learn to say it and say it politely, or people will push us around. So here is our lesson today, a word that can make people frown, a word that can sometimes hurt feelings, though be no, it's only a sound. Just put your tongue at the top,
Is everyone ready to go? We're saying that word that is so hard to say. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Well, okay. It's no.
Between the two, Tom T obviously has a much better developed lyric and melody. Tom T manages to work up a nice little life lesson, even. On the other hand, Riding in My Car rocks most righteously, and it makes a much better song to actually dance to with a child. That's a significant point. Let's proceed, then, to a final exhibit representing their best respective art. I want to give the legend the last word, so we'll start with Tom T, and I'll maybe even handicap Tom T just a little bit. Rather than one of his million-selling radio hits, I'll make the case for Tom T with a little-known post-commercial art song from his 1996 Songs from Chop Toppy album called Shoes and Dress That Alice Wore.
I'm humming as I walk this house and do my daily chores. When I put the broom away, I see the dress that Alice wore. It's hanging in the closet, sadly sagging without form. Empty dress there in the closet, held a body soft and warm. Shoes and dress that Alice wore. It's the dress she wore the night she caught me lying there beside some strange woman meaning nothing, just some bones and hair and hide. I could not explain it to her, and I cannot to this day. Now I stand here staring at the dress she wore to go away. Shoes and dress that Alice wore. And the shoes are red and shiny, and they're modest in the heel. And the dress a bad investment, and the color could be teal. She went screaming from the room where I lay blinking in the nude, with the woman there beside me saying, ain't this woman rude? Shoes and dress that Alice wore. So I asked the undertaker in a private kind of way, before you close the casket when our friends have gone away, if it's not too strange to reason, I would make one last request. Since it all goes in the ground, I'd like to have the shoes and dress. Shoes and dress that Alice wore. So I'm humming as I walk this house and do my daily chores. When I put the broom away, I see the dress that Alice wore. It's hanging in the closet, sadly sagging without form. Empty dress there in the closet, held a body soft and warm. Shoes and dress that Alice wore.
Now, let's listen to Woody Guthrie exhibit his very best song, Pretty Boy Floyd. Keep Tom T's song in mind for comparison. How does Woody compare in the melody department? Which tune is more developed and more memorable? Which tune has the most emotional effect? Which has the more memorable and emotional content in harmonies and chords? Which one has made a better arrangement that adds the most meaning to the song? Which one has the more artful or the most meaningful lyric that gives some artistic light to the human condition? Listen to Woody and make your own judgment, and then I'll come back and offer mine.
Here's a little story I believe I'll sing about it. I want to say, though, that Pretty Boy did get shot down, like all outlaws, and his character gets shot down. some way or another by one of their own men or by one of the Judases in the deal. One of the dirty little cowards in the Jesse James songs. Pretty boy got his and he's laying in his grave right today, but I want to venture to say without stretching the truth that Pretty Boy Floyd is sung about on more lips and more mouths and thought better of in more hearts. He's all around more popular than any governor that Oklahoma ever had. Come and gather around me, children, and the story I will tell of Pretty Boy Floyd the Outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in Shawnee, on a Saturday afternoon, his wife beside him in his wagon, and into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff reproached him in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of anger, and his wife she overheard. Now Pretty Boy grabbed a log chain and the deputy grabbed his gun. In the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. Then he took to the tree and timber along the river shore, hiding on the river bottom, and he never come back no more. Yes, he took to the trees and timber to live a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. There's a many a starving farmer, the same old story told, how this outlaw paid their mortgage and he saved their little home. Others tell you about a stranger that comes to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There was a whole carload of groceries come with a note to say, say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Yes, it's through this world I've hoboed. I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you a sixth gun, some with a fountain pen, but as through your life you ramble, yes, as through your life you roam, you won't ever see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
comparison a little, let's compare the core melodies. Woody's melody is somewhat loose in meter, not real smooth, but it is pretty catchy. You can hum that back. That's pretty good. Now, Shoes and Dress That Alice Wore has a tighter, professional quality melody. The meter and rhythm make a sharper pattern. Every syllable of melody counts in that pattern. There weren't extra notes being shoehorned in to accommodate more text, as in Pretty Boy Floyd. I suppose you could argue that the rough edges of Woody's songs are more meaningful to you than the slick, professional smooth of Tom T. in this song, and perhaps in general. I would, of course, argue that this is just a highfalutin excuse for sloppiness. But beside the technical aspect of the longer and more developed melody lines, there seems to be a much stronger and more distinct emotional content of thoughtful, quiet sadness in Shoes and Dress than any distinct emotion inherent in the tune of Pretty Boy Floyd. Mileage may vary there. What do you think? Now, some of that superior emotional impact I'm attributing to Shoes and Dress may be coming from the beautiful studio arrangement. Some of that impact may be those sad strings. Those things count. So you may want to go back and listen to the Birds recording to get the best case for the underlying song. Which now makes me wonder how much of the outstanding beauty of the Birds recording of Pretty Boy Floyd had to do with Guthrie's song and how much with the loving arrangement they made of it. Now, the words of Pretty Boy Floyd are coherently written and have a discernible point, basically recasting the famous bank robber as not really a villain, but rather a Robin Hood character because he gave some of his stolen money to help poor people. You say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Well, here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Ultimately, Guthrie's point is an attack on the bankers that Floyd was robbing. Some will rob you with a six gun, some with a fountain pen. The words make a decently written point. But Shoes and Dress That Alice Wore just completely runs away with being a superior lyric. The narrator's wife caught him in bed with some whore and then ran away screaming and killed herself. Now the husband keeps her clothes hanging in his closet, sadly sagging without form, to punish himself. There's a story with different levels of implications. By the time those words are attached to the sad, reflective melody in the arrangement, Tom T. has generated multiple layers of loneliness, sadness, and guilt. In short, Shoes and Dress That Alice Wore shoots light years past Woody's best song in the technical skills of execution and also in the emotional meaning past Woody's mere polemics. So then, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I submit to you, based on all this, that Tom T. Hall is a serious musical artist and that Woody Guthrie simply was not. Woody had neither the skills nor even the intent of being a real musician or a real songwriter. You can scrape up maybe half a dozen decent Woody songs, at best. Tom T. Hall sold probably literally 1,000 times more records than Woody Guthrie, not because he was a part of some fantasy Nashville mafia, but because he was 1,000 times better artist. Hopefully, you're getting that my point in all this is not simply to bash on Woody Guthrie. Indeed, I've tried to give him full credit for the little bit of good he accomplished musically. Rather, I would hope that you, gentle listeners, would take the point as instructional. Here's how to analyze and try to reach deeper understanding and meaning from music, here are some of the things to listen for in any kind of music. I take Tom T. Hall versus Woody as the particular point of comparison to get at my points, partly because of Bob Dylan's disparaging comments. Beyond that, though, Woody versus Tom T. makes a useful contrast of art versus artifice. Artistically speaking, Woody Guthrie was all hat and no cattle. He's all legend and persona, and hardly anything worthwhile as a musician. Tom T., however, was never trying to cast some big mythology about himself. He just knuckled down, learned his craft, and wrote great songs. Indeed, I would rate Tom T. Hall as the greatest country songwriter ever, with due respect to Dolly Parton and Hank Williams, among others. I can't see how anybody could listen to Tom T. and Woody back to back and miss that point. So, that completes the musical comparison. Now, let me step back a step two to make the broader point that the cult of Woody Guthrie has been built on fraud and foolishness, root and branch. For just a tiny point of that, consider the Pretty Boy Floyd song. Guthrie was of such mind to make his point against bankers that he left out the real outlaw, who was a murderer, because that would undercut the cheap sentimentality and moral equivalence he was shooting for. Yeah, some poor families got a nice Christmas dinner, but Woody didn't have anything to say for the wives and children of the people that the guy murdered. Their Christmas probably wasn't so pleasant. This is Guthrie's best song, and I'll give him due credit for a great song. But at that, it is essentially a lie. Woody wrote a whole album about convicted murderers Sacco and Vanzetti. Note particularly the song Vanzetti's Letter, where he's at pains to defend the propriety of their proven lies. Not to put too fine a point on it, Woody Guthrie was a fake musician with a cheesy contrived persona, sold as a supposed man of the people, though he was never any kind of hit. He was a government-promoted hack who arose from the people about as spontaneously and caught on about as well as President Obama's bought and paid for astroturf of his Occupy Wall Street bowel movement. This would all be as opposed to, for example, Merle Haggard, whom Dylan also dissed in his little Music Hair speech. Merle never presumed or angled to be considered a spokesman for the working man. He got that job because millions of actual working people spontaneously latched on to his personal sentiments and identified with the real Okie. From Muskogee, Oklahoma, USA. Yet Bob Dylan has repeatedly argued that Woody Guthrie is the great model of songwriting. Screw anything actually popular on the radio or supposed hacks like Lieber and Stoller or Tom T. Hall. Actually listening to Woody Guthrie's music, this is patently ridiculous nonsense, even as it relates to his number one student, Bob Dylan. In what way, having anything to do with music, did Bob Dylan get anything at all from Woody Guthrie that showed him how to go about writing, say, All Along the Watchtower, or I Believe in You, or Tangled Up in Blue? Some people get all built up on someone like Woody Guthrie or Pete Seeger because of their progressive political religion. Everything in life is about the cause, and anybody that carries on with left-wing nonsense is deep and profound. That really doesn't apply to Bob Dylan in particular, though. He was never particularly much of a leftist. The real appeal of Woody Guthrie to a lot of pop musicians and such has little to do with politics at all, but something really worse. Guthrie and Seeger are role models in moral self-aggrandizement. Bob Dylan has been widely acknowledged in that regard. He loves playing like an Old Testament prophet, wagging that finger of judgment at people. It's big I, little you. No, it's not enough to be a rich, famous singer. Bruce Springsteen has to be the spokesman for the common man. My hero, Elvis Costello, just has to cast himself as, in his words, a voice of conscience. This kind of cheap moral narcissism strikes me as grotesque, petty, and contemptible. Besides being unseemly, it blinds people morally, leading, for example, to Pete Seeger's truly wicked and ugly championing of genocidal communist. That's enough of that, though, so I'll just stop wagging my own finger in judgment. I find it unfortunately needful sometimes, but it's not pretty and I don't enjoy it. In conclusion, then, I want to lighten up a little on Woody. I do enjoy smacking down false idols, and I find that sacred cows make the very tastiest burgers. But I don't want to denounce poor Woody for everybody else's sins. So, plus years of getting all my news from Fox News has taught me the importance of being fair and balanced. Thus, I want to give the last word on Woody Guthrie to his son Arlo Guthrie.
I think one of the wonderful things about my dad that I learned from him, not from him personally, but from his work, and not just learned it, but appreciated it, saw it one day, woke up, like I wasn't sleeping or nothing, but I woke up, you know, and began to realize that, or began to realize some of the sacrifice that a person has to make when you're dealing with things like being free in every moment to pursue and to be who you are. And there's a price that has to be paid for those things.
Let me finish up with some gratitude and thanks. I am grateful to the Lord for making Bob Dylan a truly great artist. I'm thankful to Dylan most particularly for my favorite song in his catalog, Bob Dylan's 115th Dream. In the visions of my own 115th dream, I am grateful to the poor Pakis and Indians who had to trail around after the Kashmir goats gathering their fur to make the beautiful coat I'm wearing. And I'm grateful to Goodwill stores and to the generous donors who made it possible for me to get a Kashmir coat for $4 and a camel hair coat for $1. Anything you can buy, I can buy cheaper. I can buy anything cheaper than you. This reminds me to be grateful for Irving Berlin, and very glad that he wrote all those Annie Get Your Gun songs, God Bless America, of course, and the little hidden gem of the Easter Parade, Snooky Ookums. And that reminds me how grateful I am for my sister Hannah and her old man, Jim Daly. Despite their yucky, snooky hookum talk. Cut it out. Finally, I am grateful to the Lord for his little church in Kentucky that spawned my hero, Tom T. Hall. And I'll offer back my humble a cappella tribute using his expression of gratitude as our final closing prayer. I love little baby ducks, old pickup trucks, slow-moving trains, and rain. I love little country streams, sleep without dreams, Sunday school in May, and hay. And I love you too. I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels. I love coffee in a cup, little fizzy pups, bourbon in a glass, and grass. And I love you too. And I love honest open smiles, kisses from a child, tomatoes on the vine, and onions. I love winners when they cry, losers when they try, music when it's good, and life. And I love you too. Dear hearts, thanks for taking an hour out of your life to spend with me. On with the show. Good health to you. And may you have a blessed day. Thanks for listening. And good night.